Welcome to the Flourishing After Addiction podcast. I'm Carl Eric Fisher, an addiction psychiatrist and bioethicist. In this podcast, I explore addiction and recovery through a series of interviews across the widest possible diversity of perspectives. I have conversations with everyone from leading academic experts to, like this episode, spiritual teachers and everything in between, including folks with lived experience, all with the ultimate aim of helping people to make sense of addiction and work toward flourishing. I'm hoping this will be a place where you can have broad, deep, curious conversations about addiction that are accessible for everyone while still respecting the need for nuance and care. If you want to learn more, please head over to my website where you can sign up for my newsletter to stay up to date with the latest episodes, show notes, and other writings. You can find that at carlericfisher.com. And in this episode, I talk with Kevin Griffin. Kevin Griffin is the author of One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps, and several other books on Buddhism and recovery. He's taught internationally, he offers weekly classes on Zoom, and he's been in recovery for 36 years and practicing Buddhist meditation since 1980. I've known him for years now. I consider him a mentor and a teacher, and I'm just really grateful to have his voice on this episode. We talk about a lot. We talk about how to integrate Buddhism and recovery, what his definition of recovery is, talk about what it is to take a spiritual approach to recovery going beyond mindfulness, how to make sense of notions like faith and higher power in a way that's not theistic, not supernatural, and what that even means to be spiritual, but not religious. Kevin is a person who has experience with 12-step recovery. I think that's great because, you know, previous guests have appropriately talked about problems with 12-step recovery, and Kevin can talk about what's good there. And I think that's one of the values of including folks with lived experience. And we also talk about what it is to work with doubt and despair in these troubled times, something I'm really feeling the need for with the climate crisis and injustice and the ongoing pandemic. And Kevin gives us a really powerful message of how to work with pain as part of the necessary part of recovery, not just one's individual pain, but the pain of the past, and just a really strong message about the why of going into pain. I found great motivation there. I hope you do too. So without further delay, here's Kevin Griffin. So hi, I'm here with Kevin Griffin. It's a real honor and a pleasure, and I have a sense that I myself selfishly am going to benefit from this conversation. So Kevin, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Great, and look forward to talking with you. We've already had some good conversations, so yeah.
And I've always really valued your perspective as one of the first people, as I see it, who thoughtfully was writing and thinking about how to integrate Buddhism and recovery. And just like a lot of people nowadays are sober curious, I think a lot of folks are Buddhism curious and may not even have a framework for understanding why the two go together, how the two go together. So I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about why integrate Buddhism and recovery. What's that about?
Yeah. Well, first, just to say that Buddhism is a big term, and the tradition that I come out of is very specifically the Theravadan Buddhist tradition of Southern Asia, of Thailand, Burma, and Sri Lanka. So it's quite different from like Tibetan Buddhism or Zen Buddhism of Japan, just to be clear, because if people are Buddhist curious, they're going to discover that there's these different streams and different approaches. You know, the question was about how Buddhism and recovery go together. Was mm-hmm. that the starting point? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess in the largest sense, many people, including myself, see recovery as a spiritual path and one that kind of demands a spiritual path, demands spiritual tools, that it's not just a matter of willpower or being educated about addiction or going through some kind of treatment that cures you. It's really deeper than that. Addiction itself is very deep, as you know. And so it demands sort of a multi-leveled approach, including treatment for many people and including education, but really particularly in maintaining it to some kind of a spiritual connection and ultimately, I would say, spiritual transformation. And of course, that's exhibited, we see that in the language of the 12 steps, which is very much spiritual or even religious sounding to many people because it talks about God and higher power. And so for someone who's not Christian or theistic, when faced with the steps, there's this innate conflict that really has to be addressed immediately. And a lot of people have turned away from the 12 steps because of that conflict, because they couldn't find an alternative. So my work in a lot of ways has been to give people an alternative way of understanding the steps using this Buddhist framework, which of course includes meditation and mindfulness, but really draws on the breadth of Buddhist teachings as I understand them. And fundamentally, what makes Buddhism a really great tool for a recovery process or working with addiction is that the foundation teachings of Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths, talk about suffering and that suffering is caused by clinging. And then the teachings for coming out of that suffering and out of that clinging are the Eightfold Path. Well, that's exactly what the addict needs, is some kind of a tool to deal with their tendency, their extreme tendency to clinging. So it's almost as if Buddhism is seeing addiction as a sort of fundamental human quality. You know, the Buddhist texts don't use the language of addiction, but clinging and grasping, these are synonyms to addiction. And so it makes perfect sense then to draw on a tradition that sort of addresses this right from the start. It's not just a peripheral idea, but it's like to the Buddhist teachings.
So the Buddhist teachings are about clinging and suffering and a way out. And am I understanding you right that in your framework and informed by a Buddhist framework, even the extreme examples of addiction are not really different from other forms of everyday human grasping and attachment?
Well, certainly they're different, but different in degree, not in kind, I think is that. And so I think of addiction or think of clinging as being on a spectrum. And on the outer edges of the spectrum, we get the addiction, but you know, the middle of it, or however, you know, wherever we start, is just, I really need to stand up right now. You know, I have a desire to stand up. You know, I really have it. I'm ready for lunch. You know, just the cravings that we all have throughout the day, throughout our lives. You know, one great Buddhist teacher says we live in a desire realm. So we're all driven by desire throughout our waking and maybe even our sleeping lives. And that's okay. I mean, it's not great. It's kind of what the Buddha was trying to sort out, but it's manageable until those desires start to become so destructive. But it's all desire. It's all craving. It's all clinging. So I realized that I went there from clinging to craving or clinging to desire. And so I should clarify that we do kind of, when I say we, I mean Buddhists, sort of mesh these two. And it's often people say that the second noble truth is that the cause of suffering is craving and clinging. So we see that craving leads directly to clinging, right? I want that. Now I've got it. I don't want to let go of it. You know, there's just a sort of seamless connection between craving and clinging. But yeah, I think it's all of a piece. And for someone practicing Buddhist meditation, as we start to watch the mind, we start to pick up the very subtle movements of craving in the mind. And this is really where a lot of insight comes from, seeing how even in a moment of seeming peace and stillness, that there's still a part of your mind that's wants a little bit more, or would just like it a little bit more comfortable, or if I could just get a little more quiet, and we become attuned to these subtle movements of mind. And then of course the more gross movements of mind become quite obvious and unmanageable, I guess.
And so you're describing this very beautifully. I think it gives us a good ground to stand on, but also for people who don't know your work, this comes to you from personal experience too, right? And
I studied this all in the Buddhist university. I have my PhD in clinging personal experience. Yes, of course. And this is certainly in the 12-step world where I got sober, you know, that's kind of where we start from, you know, our stories and our experience. And there's a, you know, when you share in a meeting, they suggest that you share your experience, strength, and hope. So starting with your experience, for sure. Is there something you wanted to know about my experience?
Well, I was curious about the way, if I'm remembering right, you found Buddhism and you were drawn to spiritual practice, but that in itself wasn't necessarily enough for you to fully face and enter recovery from your addictions. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. I mean, there's so many, you know, to try to pick apart your own story and how it all played out. You know, I was just on the phone with one of my older brothers talking about some sort of insights and realizations I had about my childhood and how I got so messed up. And it was really interesting because, like, of course, he had a totally different experience of our family, which is what I was talking about. But my version of my story is kind of that, yeah, I had this longing for some spiritual fulfillment, and my addiction was kind of another form of that in a way. It was the addiction, you know, why do we drink and take drugs? You know, we want to feel good. We want to, but there is some sort of longing that we're trying to satisfy that isn't entirely just an addictive longing. Part of it is this kind of spiritual angst or sense that, you know, maybe if I take this drug, it's going to really create a transcendent experience. Of course, we know in the psychedelic movement, that's taken very seriously. So I kind of came upon Buddhist meditation in this lifelong really attempt to solve my own pain. But it was also a kind of longing to escape, you know, that longing to take care of my pain wasn't exactly like, oh, let me really deal with my pain. It was maybe if I meditate enough, my pain will go away. You know, I won't have to face it or deal with it or figure it out. So it didn't work, you know, and I got pretty serious. I mean, I went on a 3-month silent retreat 5 years before I got sober. So that's going pretty deep. But eventually even that spiritual search became somewhat warped, you know, and I kind of, it got kind of corrupted into like, oh, I can be like a enlightened drunk or something, you know, mindful, you know, drug taking. And so it didn't work, which was good because it made me eventually realize that I had to face this basic thing, my persistent drug and alcohol use, which I had always felt would just go away once I became enlightened. You know, if I meditate enough, then I just won't care about drinking anymore. So again, it was like, I don't really want to deal with the problem. I just want it to magically go away. And I don't want to really admit that it's a core problem. That's one of the real challenges. I always thought, oh, it's just a, you know, that's a peripheral problem, the drugs and alcohol. The real problem is my angst, you know, my depression, my me, you know.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. So in other words, you wanted your mindfulness practice or your meditation practice to take away your pain, You wanted to be a mindful drunk, and you thought that there was just some fix or some hack.
Yeah.
Could just make you into the version of you thought you wanted to be.
Yeah, exactly. And we didn't have hacks in those days, so, you know.
Probably different terminology. But you mentioned earlier, you made a comment about how Buddhism is not just mindfulness. It's not just meditation, which I think is one of those tensions that's really live today. So I was hoping to ask if you could just take us beyond the mindfulness piece. Why is it integrating your practice of Buddhism with the 12 steps and not like integrating meditation with the 12 steps?
Yeah, I think that the starting point is to look at the Eightfold Path, which is, I've kind of mentioned it in passing before, the kind of tools that the Buddha offers to escape from suffering, to abandon suffering. And so it's got several different kind of elements to it. Obviously it has eight, but sort of thematically, the starting point is our ethical and moral behavior. And this is one of the first things that kind of gets dropped from the mindfulness movement, you know. And certainly when I started meditating, it wasn't a priority by any means. So understanding that how we live outside of the meditation hall is equally important to what happens inside the meditation hall is a critical idea. And so right action, which involves sort of the typical moral strictures, you know, not to kill, not to steal, not to harm sexually, not to lie, and not to use intoxicants, you know, not to kind of cloud the mind. That gets you somewhere already. And speech is, you know, very, very much focused on, because there's one particular part of the Eightfold Path is on right speech. And then even livelihood, you know, all these things are part of the kind of foundational spiritual development in Buddhist tradition. And then the meditation, which is considered to be a training of the mind, really, you know, a training of the mind so that we can see clearly. It's not meditating so you get rid of stress, you know, or that you become a better Wall Street trader because you're sharper, you know, that it gives you clarity to see. And it gives you clarity to also see into your morality. You know? So it's not just seeing wisdom, but it's also seeing like, oh, am I really speaking the truth? Or is the way I'm treating this woman or man sort of sexually inappropriate, you know, and how am I, you know, am I really being honest? You know, just the sort of clarity that sometimes we see all of a sudden like, oh, I didn't realize what was behind that. Like, I thought I was being a nice guy, but really, you know, I was being selfish. So all of that comes through the training of the mind. And then classically, then out of that arises insight, which is both personal in that way of kind of seeing your own thoughts, your own behaviors, your own conditioning, but then finally transcendent wisdom of seeing emptiness, seeing that everything is impermanent, seeing how the mind creates a self, an idea of a self, and how our attachment to all those things causes suffering. And now we have this whole worldview that goes from the mundane and the daily practical elements of life all the way to awakening to this transcendent realization. And so the meditation is kind of in the middle of that, right? It's not the end of it. It's not the culmination. It's really just part of the development. And so this becomes, you know, much more than a lifestyle. You know, it becomes a life. It becomes a foundational way of living your life. And I'll say, to bring it back to recovery, that in the 12th step of that comes out of Alcoholics Anonymous and other programs, the last line is that we practice these principles in all our affairs. So the teaching out of the 12 steps is saying the same thing, that we are not just trying to get sober, you know, in or clean or deal with whatever our addiction is, but that we're trying to cultivate these spiritual qualities, which will become part of our entire life and infiltrate every aspect of our lives. And that's another way that Buddhism and the 12 steps connect, that they are both really trying to address life. They aren't just sort of, you know, something you do on Sunday morning or, you know, you do at your yoga class. It's really an entire different way of living and viewing the world.
Mm-hmm. And it's not something that you schedule into your day as a dose of a intervention to get some sort of effect on your brain.
Right. And, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's great. And I think everybody should schedule that into their day, because the clarity that comes from that dose of meditation does help. You know, it supports all the rest of that happening. It's not, you can do all the rest of that in terms of the life, sort of lifestyle and transcendent vision or understanding of the world, but it really supports it to have this mental training each day to keep the mind attuned in that way. Because our minds are so deeply conditioned to fall into the habits of craving, of what the Buddha calls greed, hatred, and delusion. We're so deeply conditioned into doing those things, we have to keep intervening. You know, it's like a daily intervention, right? And really, in a lot of ways, a moment-by-moment intervention. That's why my book is called One Breath at a Time, right? Because you have to catch it. Every breath, the mind is ready to go off.
So you mentioned that people have stumbling blocks around 12-step practice. And because the founders were, you know, very clearly embedded in a particular Judeo-Christian worldview, and that's very explicit at portions in the text. So people really struggle with notions like, for example, higher power. And I think a lot of people, even outside of an addiction or recovery context, would look at Buddhism and say, hey, wait a second, I thought Buddhism didn't deal in any sort of metaphysics. I thought there wasn't any sort of spirituality in the sense of like a supernatural or something. So then how do you make sense of that notion, for example, in a Buddhist context?
I mean, first of all, just as an aside, the early Buddhist texts have all kinds of supernatural stuff in them. It's just that Westerners have decided to put that aside and say, oh, that's not important, or that's not what he was really talking about, or whatever. That's our version of it.
Very important point.
But given that it's true that we don't see like a monotheism or a creator God who is kind of controlling our lives, that Buddhism is based on the principle of cause and effect or the law of karma, that there isn't some higher power that's going to intervene in our lives if we turn our lives, our will and our lives over to the Buddha. He's not going to like, you know, get us sober. So the way I look at it is that when you say, as step three says, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the power of God as we understood him, if I take out the word God and I replace it with Dharma, which is the Buddhist teachings, the teachings of the Buddha in the broadest sense, then I can be talking about the powers that are inherent to different elements of the Dharma. So this gets complicated, which is why I wrote one book on this topic. You know, I thought I'd kind of addressed it in One Breath at a Time. And afterward, people kept saying to me, yeah, but what about higher power? I was like, didn't I cover that? And they're like, well, I need to hear more. So my second book is called A Burning Desire, Dharma, God, and the Path of Recovery. And it starts with the idea that the law of karma, the law of cause and effect, that is that every action has an effect, and that actions take the form of thoughts, words, and deeds. That is that thoughts, words, and deeds create karma, create effects. That's very powerful. It is the power that more or less determines, maybe not even more or less, that pretty much determines the path of our lives, how our lives unfold is, you know, beyond the externals that we are not in control of, the things that we think, the things that we say, and the things that we do, and the results of those things are what kind of determine how our lives go. And the law of karma has kind of some boundaries to it. It has some rules. And this is where faith comes in. This is one area where I would say there is faith in Buddhism, which is essentially that there is a moral fabric to the universe. That if you do what the Buddha calls wholesome activities or have wholesome thoughts or wholesome speech, that there will be beneficial results or wholesome results. That if you don't do unwholesome thoughts, words, and deeds, if you think with greed, hatred, and delusion, if you act out of greed, hatred, and delusion, if you speak out of those, that the results are going to be negative. They're going to be harmful. They're going to harm you. They're going to harm others. Now, there's no exact one-to-one, oh, if you, you know, spit on the sidewalk, then you're going to spend this many days in prison or whatever. You know, it's not like, you know, if I give this money to a homeless person, I should immediately go buy a lottery ticket because I've created good karma. No, it's not that simple. The law of karma is much more subtle and complex than that. However, it has a basic framework of the wholesome and the unwholesome and those skills. So that's a power greater than me. I can't screw with it. You know, I can't steal and think that there's not going to be no repercussions. That doesn't mean I'm going to get caught. But what it does mean is that my mind has been poisoned now. And there's going to be fear of getting caught. There's going to be guilt about it, unless I'm a sociopath, in which case, you know, the law of karma kind of has different impacts on sociopaths, which I've never really gotten into that topic. It's an interesting one for somebody to get into. But for most of us, if we do unskillful things and unwholesome things, they redound on us. We know that somehow it either internally, I mean, when you look at people and you think, oh, they got away with it. My thought always is, no, they're living with that. You know, that's inside them. And if they are acting out of greed, hatred, and delusion, it means that they are experiencing greed, hatred, and delusion, which are inherently painful. So when you see these super rich people who seem to be screwing over the world, you think, man, they're getting away with it. No, they're not, because they're living with their own greed. And that's painful. You know, it's just very simple. You know, my daughter just sent me a little video of Clay Thompson. I don't know if you guys in Brooklyn know who he is.
No, who's Clay Thompson?
Clay Thompson is an NBA basketball player. He plays for the Warriors. He's an all-star, one of the best basketball players in the world. And he tore his Achilles and he's been out for a while. Somebody had a video of him they ran into him in Chipotle. And Clay is this just sweet guy, very playful. And this guy is asking him in Chipotle, like, oh, what, do you have any advice for like entrepreneur athletes? I'm thinking, I don't even know what that is, but it's sort of, you know, the guy's like trying to make and Clay says a few things and then he kind of clicks in. You can see that like he's kind of goofing around and then he kind of clicks in. He's like, you know, don't make it about the material stuff. And then I wrote down, he said, it's all about inner peace and doing something you're passionate about. And this is a guy who knows, because he's got tens of millions of dollars. He's got NBA rings. He's won 3 championships. And his body broke down and he's happy. You know, I mean, he's coming back. Go Warriors. But he knows all that money, all of those rings. No, that's not what's making me happy. Because I'm taking care of myself internally. It's always the key, right? We know that. And yet society tells us, I mean, I hate to even say that phrase. It sounds so cliched, but it is. We, these cultural, these signals we get from society are, you need to make money. You need to have a beautiful partner. You need to be powerful, all this stuff. You know, you need to have look a certain way and all this stuff that we know from kindergarten that that doesn't work, that it's not true, but it gets into us. And so, you know, this idea, I guess what I'm getting at is, I think most people, again, non-sociopaths, sort of know right from wrong and sort of know what creates good karma, but we don't do it, you know? And so when the 12 steps said, we turn our will and our lives over to the care of the Dharma, and I say to myself, okay, what that means is I need to really consider what I'm, notice what I'm thinking about, which takes mind training, notice what I'm saying, notice what I'm doing, and keep remembering, is that in alignment with the law of karma or not? Because if it's not, it's gonna come back on me. And it's fairly simple, but it's very powerful because, again, I can't get around it. I can't cheat it, you know? You know, we all know this, but we try to cheat it. And as an addict, you're absolutely trying to cheat the law of karma. You're trying to get, I want to be high, and like in this like ecstatic state or, you know, intoxicated state. And I want to have no repercussions from it, you know, and that's just inherently not possible. And it's denial of the law of karma. So for me, coming back to this question of higher power, it starts with the law of karma. And then the Buddhist teachings about morality, about speech, about training the mind, about insight, all then are actions of either mind or body, which create positive karma. That's what the Eightfold Path is trying to do. It's trying to take the wise actions that lead to freedom, ultimately. I mean, there's an ultimate place to get to, this transcendent, you know, nirvana experience of the ultimate. But before you get there, there's all these other positive things that can happen along the way. And it's this path of skillful action, thoughts, words, and deeds.
It's a great taste of a whole set of considerations that you have around other stumbling blocks. And we're not going to go through, I'm not going to make you go through every single potential stumbling block that people have over the 12 steps. Because my purpose is not to try to convince people to sign up for this or that. But I also think that it's not your mission to just translate the 12 steps into some sort of Buddhist terms and kind of make it all fit together beautifully. Like what I get from your writings is a set of considerations on these impossibly hard problems and paradoxes from age-old teachings that are really beautiful. And I love that you said the word faith. That's in my experience too, with my own practice of Buddhism, is that it's not faithless. It's not like some science of the mind. It's not that just that neuroimaging shows us the way that the brain works. There is a leap of faith involved where you have to believe in something bigger than yourself, or I have to believe in something bigger than myself. And to pretend that that's not faith is misleading.
That's right. I mean, to sit down and close your eyes and try to follow your breath for 20 minutes implies some faith that doing nothing, apparently, it can have some value, that something that appears to be non-productive can actually be productive. And so that's just the starting point of faith in the Dharma. Trusting that making a sacrifice, doing something kind in a situation where you could do something selfish is going to be worth doing, that's also faith, because it might look like you're being a sucker. You know, that's kind of the way that the kind of zero sum folks look at it. Oh, if you do something nice for people, then you're just being a sucker. It's like, no, you don't understand karma, you know?
So with faith, I mean, with faith comes doubt, and these are troubled times. You wrote another book about troubled times.
Yes.
And we're recording this at a, for me, just sharing personally, it's a particularly dark time. It's a dark time regarding vaccinations, both here in the US and also the way that we're letting vaccines get thrown in the trash here while there's no access in other countries. And you're talking to me from California, where wildfires are out of control, so much more, the world is on fire. And it can be hard, I think, and I've seen this in my practice, and I'm sure you've seen this in your teaching over the past year, it can be hard to maintain a sense of faith and to work with, and you and I have even talked about this previously, to work with a sense of doubt, or maybe doubt is not even the right word for it. Maybe it's a word like despair. And so I just think that's a really crucial question, a message for people right now. Do you have any help to offer us on working with that sort of bigger picture despair?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you that on the night of the presidential election last November, when it looked like things were not going well for the candidate that I supported, and I started to go into a real, real heavy fear, despair state. I stepped away from the TV and I went and lay on my bed. It was like 9 o'clock at night. It was not bedtime for me, you know. It's like, and I just recalled taking refuge. So this is a Buddhist idea that we take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. The Sangha is the community. The Buddha is both the teacher and the idea, the transcendent ideal, sort of the archetypal ideal. And the Dharma, as I said, is the teachings, and more broadly, the truth, the ultimate truth. And I just reflected on the fact that from this broad, 10,000, 35,000 foot view, everything is impermanent. America is impermanent. America arose and America will pass away at some time. The earth is impermanent. In a several billion years, the sun will explode and the solar system will be gone. And that kind of big picture that this is as awful and as true as suffering can be and as tragic as it can be, to see things like people throwing away the opportunity to be healthy. I mean, the amount of privilege you have to have to think, oh, I'm not going to take that vaccine when people are literally dying to get it, is pretty amazing. But yeah, I just take that. Sometimes I just have to step way, way back. And if I have to go into geological time to get far enough away, okay, I'll do it. If I just have to go into historical time, a few hundred years, I was talking to, I mentioned, I think that I was talking to my brother this morning. Did I say that? Yeah, I think I did. I'm old enough that I can forget what I said half an hour ago. And I was talking to him about my innocence as a child, my misunderstanding of our family, and then the disappointment I had when things didn't turn out to be the way I thought they were. But that's very much also what can happen to us around America. And, the 1619 Project is kind of this breaking of our innocence. It's like, that's one of the most direct ways that we've kind of broken American innocence. And some people, have to be in denial about that. But in order to heal and to grow, we have to take it in. We have to take in the pain of our past. Just like we do have to in therapy, as that we have to, it doesn't do any good to stay in denial that will eventually, whatever the issue is, will eventually undermine us and we'll, we'll wind up paying the price for our denial. And so being honest about what America is, or being honest about what reality is, that everything is impermanent, that I'm going to die, then I can learn to hold that. A spiritually mature person holds the truth. And we understand, we bring compassion to it because we understand that it's inherently tragic, that life is, by literary standards, inherently tragic, because anytime the hero dies at the end of the play, it's a tragedy. And since we all die at the end of our personal play, each of our lives can be viewed as a tragedy. So how do we hold that? We have to hold it with compassion, with love, with this broad understanding of that it's beautiful and tragic, and we have to learn to have equanimity around that. And all of that is the training, the mind training of our meditation practice and the insight, wisdom that can come out of that, so that we can live in these troubled times, in this troubled world. You know, to think that somehow we're living in a unusually difficult time in history, I think is to be pretty innocent and pretty much in denial. I mean, most of human history, most people were on the verge of starvation. You know, they were serfs, and there was this tiny elite. You know, we don't have to go back very far to see times that were just as bad. You know, having a disease that can kill everybody is awful, but you and I are still talking to each other from 3,000 miles apart. How bad is that? You know? So yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure if I answered whatever the question was, but I think big pictures is for me the only way I can manage these things, besides just self-care, you know, as much self-care and kindness as I can muster.
That was very helpful. I think it was a beautiful answer. I felt your centeredness and your capacity to gain perspective and find refuge. And what I heard you say is the returning to that notion of faith and taking refuge in something bigger than the self. And then also to go to the earth, like go to the wisdom of the earth and trust in that and get rid of this, not get rid of, but to get some perspective on this sometimes very like narcissistic, very small story about the individual self. And I think, you know, to ground it, I know you're not saying this, but that's not a thing that someone in active addiction is necessarily going to do, to like go to the mountains and touch a rock and think about geology, and then that's a cure for addiction. But I see a possibility in you, and I'm not there yet necessarily, not every day. You know, it takes me more than lying on the bed for a little bit to get centered some days, but I have faith in that possibility from a practice mindset, from the ability to train not just the mind, but to train oneself in a manner of being, in a manner of relationship with the world.
Right. Yeah. Nice. Thank you.
I wanted to ask about, well, your discussion of karma brought this up for me too, because you talked about how karma is not some sort of like immediate deposit system where you get a better birth necessarily because you pick up the trash, but it's a set of ideas about how actions and intentions redound onto you. And it made me think of attention that I think recovery communities and also Buddhist communities are really sitting with now, which is the tension between individual work and an engagement in a broader sociocultural suffering. In other words, like, is it enough to practice for some sort of, you know, limited local release, or is it necessary for awakening to engage in issues like social justice and oppression? And is that part of the path, or is that somehow misplaced in Buddhism? Is that just some nice white folks who are trying to feel better about themselves, so they suck up notions of social justice into their practice?
Well, I certainly think that if we're really embracing Buddhist ethics, we have to apply them to the greater world and our role in the world. So, yeah, I mean, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's one of the great modern scholars of Buddhism, who spent decades translating the early Buddhist texts from a monastery in Sri Lanka. He's American, from Brooklyn, actually. He came back to America some 15 or 20 years ago. When I say America, I should say the United States, because he did want to kind of re-engage in the world. And he wrote a famous essay called A Challenge to Buddhists that you can find on, you know, if you Google it, it was in the magazine Lion's Roar. And it's addressing this very question, saying that Buddhism should not be just used for a sort of dealing with your own personal problems, that you have to address the larger suffering in the world, the implications of the first double truth, the truth of suffering, that they have to be addressed on a more of a global scale. And he started an organization called Buddhist Global Relief to just feed people. And it's a great organization. And he also, in that essay, though, also says, but we have to watch out that our engagement doesn't just fit nicely with sort of mainstream left-wing causes, you know, and so, which you're sort of implying in the way you phrased that question. So, yeah, no doubt to really bring a Buddhist practice and a Buddhist life to fruition means to live it beyond our own personal practice. And the key thing in terms of how we do express that is that we watch what the energy is behind our engagement. Are we coming out of anger? Are we coming out of greed? You know, what's really driving us? What's motivating us? How is it impacting our minds? Because if we find maybe we're doing something very skillful, but we're getting so caught up in it that it's causing us more stress and problems, then maybe it's a time to draw back a little bit. And so that idea of balance, of equanimity, is really vital when we engage in the world, because the world so easily throws us out of balance. And so it's to really kind of pick your concerns, you know, pick the things you're going to be engaged in carefully so that you know they're really in tune with your values, and then engage to the degree that you can do skillfully without harming yourself or others. It's pretty generic.
I don't think so. I think it's great advice. It's great advice in that it raises this theme that I think most Buddhist ideas or Buddhist practice concepts, if they're not handled with my experience solely as a practitioner, not as a teacher, is that they, without discernment, without care, all this stuff just adapts itself to the prevailing ideologies.
Yeah.
It's not magic. It's not like if you meditate hard enough, racism goes away. It's not like if you meditate enough, then, you know, you're going to be right about everything. We've got a whole legacy of ethical abuses within Buddhist traditions and otherwise to show us that. So just a call for caution and like real discernment and humility is what I'm hearing from you.
Yeah, I mean, right. Because as I said before, the tendencies of the mind to fall back into different forms of desire, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are so powerful that we have to constantly be checking. You know, and yeah, it's spiritual ideas can so easily be corrupted. You know, the one that is very common around diversity and racism is people say, you know, when one group in a Buddhist community says, well, we really want to make space for a BIPOC group, or we want to, you know, allow people to have a LGBT sitting group or something, that other people are like, oh, but Buddhism says we are all one, and we should all just, you know, we shouldn't be separating ourselves in these ways. And it's a typical corruption of the teachings on transcendent wisdom or absolute truth that doesn't recognize that the absolute and the relative have to hold equal space. To say that on some absolute level, everything is empty doesn't mean that I don't need to have a driver's license, you know. So in order to function in the world, we need to hold those two truths skillfully and act on the one that's needed in a given moment. So in the moment when I felt like all is lost in the presidential election, I needed an absolute truth thought to hold me to get through that. But before that, in the months before that, I was making phone calls in order to get people to vote the way I wanted them to vote, because there's the, you know, there's the practical, there's that relative world we live in. And then there's this transcendent truth, and both of them are real. Both of them are truths. And one of the truths about racism is that all humans are the same, and yet we don't treat them the same. And they live in completely different experience. They have completely different experiences of being alive in different societies. And to deny that is to deny their humanity, their ultimate humanity. It's to try to cut them off from some aspect of their experience.
It's well said. It's a good call for humility and checking and care.
Yeah.
It's much appreciated. Now to bring it back to maybe the individual, because this podcast is called Flourishing After Addiction. I'm wondering, I got a whole bunch of ideas and stuff I could throw in the show notes, but like say someone came to you and it was an early recovery or maybe even a couple years in, feeling pretty solid, feeling safe, no huge risk of relapse, but also feeling like there's something missing. There's something more they're looking for a more complete vision of flourishing. Well, what's your advice? Even leaving the Buddhism aside, what would you say? How would you help that person with that?
I'm not sure I could leave the Buddhism aside.
Fair
because
enough.
That really is, it's just that person that I was writing my first book for. It's just that person that I was trying to address, that because I feel like what happens for many people is that if they get through the initial stages of recovery, they kind of deal with the addiction itself and the sort of inventory and amends things that the work they have to do to kind of get their life back to semi-normal. But then they can kind of hit a wall where that's not enough. We're just working the steps or praying or, you know, going to meetings just doesn't really fulfill them. And that's where I think the Dharma really expands on these ideas that they already know. And it really can help them to take this into, I guess we could say, a more positive movement, where we can think of early recovery as negative in the sense that I'm just trying to get rid of the bad stuff. So in Buddhism, in right effort, the first thing is, you know, abandoning the unskillful stuff. But then there's this cultivating the skillful stuff, cultivating the wholesome. So that sometimes isn't that much vision of that in the 12-step world or in the recovery world in general. It's mostly like deal with that addiction and then go on and live your life. But what does your life look like without that thing that was your entertainment and your social life and your experience of elation and all of that? How do you, that needs to be replaced. And the positive aspects of Dharma, loving kindness, cultivating joy, more mindfulness and really being more present for your life, being more compassionate, you know, all of that can really enrich our lives beyond, as you say, help you to flourish after addiction. And I would even go so far as to say that just meditating itself can help to attune the mind in a way that we actually receive and appreciate life more, because we have this clarity that helps us to be grateful for the warmth, for the rain that's falling on me, for, you know, just for the simple things that that get completely obscured by intoxication. So recovery itself can help us with that. But as you attune the mind and get more clarity with mindfulness and, you know, deepening concentration, then there really appreciation and joy that comes spontaneously out of the world.
I was just talking with Eric Garland, who is a distinguished psychology researcher who studies mindfulness, and he has a theory called the mindfulness to meaning theory, which is exactly that. exactly what you just articulated, that in very straightforward psychological research, that mindfulness can help people with addiction to reset their natural rewards. So all these things are rewarding. The feeling of a breeze against your cheek, or resting in the sunshine, or a cool sip of water. These are deeply, deeply rewarding experiences, but we lose the capacity to appreciate that reward, and mindfulness can inject some of that back in. It's really lovely. So glad to have that articulation from a totally different angle.
I'm glad that just through my experience, I didn't even have to go to graduate school and get a PhD and get an NIH grant and do all that research. I just like made it up.
Yeah.
Much, I tried to take the quick, easy route, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. Which is the, I mean,
40 years of the quick, easy route.
40 years of Buddhist practice. If that's the quick and easy route, that's a tricky one. But anyway, stay tuned for that episode of the podcast, because then you get to hear it from a different angle.
That sounds great.
Kevin, I've taken up a lot of your time, and it's been nourishing for me. It's really been lovely and grounding. Just wonderful to connect with you at this time, even over 3,000 miles. So I appreciate it.
Well, it's great you're doing this.
Do you want to take a minute to tell folks where they can find you and where you'd like to direct them to?
Yeah, for sure. Well, my website is kevingriffin.net. So you find pretty much everything there. What you can get on my Zoom classes, which are just drop in Tuesday mornings, Friday evenings, West Coast time. And all my books are listed there. Over the last year and a half, you know, I started doing the Zoom classes, of course, in March of 2020. And we started recording them, I think, in May. And so there's about 80 of them now on YouTube as well. There's audio on my website, but you can go to YouTube if you want to stare at me for an hour. The classes are just an hour. And I'm starting to go out and teach live, going to North Carolina in September. Hopefully I don't die. Although I'm ready to die. I mean, in the sense that, you know, I feel fulfilled. I don't mean that in any, you know, morbid way.
Yeah, don't die. Don't die, Kevin. But it's
prefer not to right now, but I'm okay with it. But anyway, yeah. So my schedule as I start to teach live, and I do a lot of other teaching besides my regular classes, you know, that people can check out on my website. So my latest book, as there are five in this series on Buddhism and recovery, the latest one is called Buddhism and the 12 Steps Daily Reflections. So it's one for each day of the year. A lot in there.
That's wonderful. Well, you know, Kevin Griffin, the, dare I say, pioneering writer and teacher in the synthesis of Buddhism and recovery. It's been a real pleasure having you on. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carl. It was a lot of fun.
That's my interview with Kevin Griffin. I really hope you found that useful, regardless of your own relationship to or perspective on recovery. I think it's interesting that Kevin talks about recovery, something demanding a spiritual path, which is an interesting counterpoint to Katie Witkowitz from episode one, who had a much broader sort of clinical and research-based definition of recovery. So make sure you check that one out at some point. It's an interesting food for thought. On the other hand, both of them together, I think, share some common ground in terms of thinking of addiction as a universal phenomenon. In particular, how Kevin talks about addiction as part of everyday human suffering and clinging from his perspective as a Theravadan Buddhist teacher. So otherwise, I'll put resources and starting points for other elements on the website. Kevin has a couple of great websites to go to. And he also wanted me to mention a bigger organization called the Buddhist Recovery Network. This is actually how we know each other. But it's a wonderful network of many, many different groups and organizations that are focused on the varied intersections between Buddhism and recovery. So I'll put that in the show notes too. Also worth noting, Kevin and I finished up with me mentioning some of Eric Garland's research on reward. And Eric Garland will actually be one of my upcoming guests, so stay tuned for that connection. In the meantime, if you're interested in diving deeper into any of these topics we've discussed, head over to my website where you can read the show notes, sign up for my newsletter. And especially if you've enjoyed this and if you think the project is useful, I'd really appreciate it if you could help me get the word out. It's really impactful if you can go to Apple Podcasts and leave me a rating and honest review. Even better is to make a direct connection with someone in your life. So right now, if you can think of someone who might find this useful, who has an interest in Buddhism or recovery or both, just shoot them a message and share the show with them. Little actions like these really have a powerful effect in these early days of the podcast, and I'd really love to keep these conversations going. I think it really makes a difference to hear the experiences of people with different perspectives on recovery and their own addiction journeys. So I'd love to keep these conversations going. Thank you so much for sharing the message. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It isn't medical or clinical advice. This content is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. So if you have questions, please consult a medical professional. Conflicts of interest are a really important topic in addiction treatment and recovery. And I think it's important for me to tell you that I don't have conflicts to declare right now. The show is just me doing my own thing to share and connect. But for the future, I'm committed to keeping an updated list of any disclosures on my website.